John chapter 8, relatively well known event in his life, especially certain parts of it anyway. What I'd like to do today is look at maybe the parts that gets overlooked and some applications that can be made concerning that. John chapter 8, start with me in verse 1. Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Early in the morning he came to the temple and all the people came to him. He sat down, he taught them. Verse 3, the scribes and the Pharisees brought to him a woman taken in adultery. And when they had set her in the midst, they said to him, Jesus, Master, this woman was taken in adultery in the very act of it. Now Moses in the law commanded that such should be stoned. What did you say? This they said, tempting him, that they might have accusation against him. But Jesus stooped down. When they had continued asking, he lifted himself up and said, he that is without sin among you, let him fire the first stone. Let him cast the first stone. He stooped down again and wrote on the ground. They which heard, that group of Pharisees and scribes who had brought the lady, they which heard it being convicted, went one by one from the oldest to the youngest until they were all gone. And Jesus was left alone, the woman standing in the midst, and Jesus lifted up himself, saw none but the woman there, and said, woman, where are your accusers? Does none condemn you? She said, no. She said, neither do I. Go and sin no more. We're familiar with that text. The woman is brought to him, and basically they just... Can you imagine the scene? And can you imagine as they say, so what do we do? Okay. We know what the law says. We want to know what you say. First of all, let's make sure we understand all the different things that's going on within this that Jesus has to deal with. In other words, in that idea of casting of the stones, first of all, he's got to deal with their hypocrisy. There are a lot of issues at stake here. The first thing is, Jesus being deity, knowing their heart, he knows the hypocrisy from which this whole thing is based. That group did not bring that lady there because they were concerned about the law. They didn't bring her because they were concerned about right and wrong. They didn't bring her because they were concerned about the woman or about any... No. Verse 6, and Jesus knew that. It was all about having something against him. They wanted him to say something that they could then point their finger at and that they could make accusation about him violating Moses' law. It was all about this incredibly intense hatred that they had toward Jesus. That's what this was all about. The first thing Jesus has to deal with is that. And so his statement was made. And that statement convicted them. In this particular matter, there are a lot of verses we can look at. There are a lot of instances in Jesus' life when this hypocrisy is so obvious. Their arrogance is so obvious. But in this particular setting, not even they had the audacity to say, I am perfect in this. And that seems to be what this verse says. Verse 8, when they had heard this, from the oldest to the youngest, they went away. They recognized in this particular setting that they were wrong, that they had not done things correctly themselves. In this particular matter, they wouldn't say, I'm perfect. They knew they weren't innocent in it. And the way we understand that, and we can be so clear about it, is in verse 4. They came to him, and they said, Master, this woman was taken in adultery, in the very act of adultery. Aren't you wondering where the man is? Taken in the very act of an adulterous act, and they only bring her? Where's the other one? She wouldn't commit adultery by herself. And that's the point Jesus is making. And that, at least in this setting, in this particular instance, that's what they recognized. They had not handled this correctly. They're trying to get him tangled up in violating the law, and yet what he does is he's just pointing out the fact you didn't do it correctly yourself. And so, they weren't innocent. The very fact that they only brought part of the sinful nature, where's the other one? And from the oldest on, they just, as Jesus is fiddling around on the ground, they just began to slip away. He has to deal with hypocrisy before he can deal with anything else. He has to deal with the law of Moses. Jesus never sinned, right? We understand that. Jesus had to deal with the law. We're not going to turn to Deuteronomy 17. You can go look it up. You're familiar with it. among two or three witnesses. That was what they were saying. They come to Jesus and they said, Moses said she should be stoned. What Deuteronomy said was if there were two or three witnesses, then it would carry on. That's how we would say the trial began. And as Jesus looks up, that's what he asked the lady. Where are your accusers? Where are the ones who are going to condemn you? And were there two or three witnesses left? No. There wasn't a single witness. How could she be stoned? No, Jesus didn't violate the commandments here. Jesus did not violate the law of Moses in this setting. The law of Moses did condemn death. The Pharisees had that right. The scribes had gotten that part right. This was a sin that could be punished to the point of death, so long as there were two or three witnesses. And the witnesses are gone. Why are the witnesses gone? Because their hypocrisy convicted them. And so Jesus couldn't stone this lady. He didn't see it. Those that were at the tabernacle hearing him teach that day, why didn't they cast stones? They didn't see it either. The ones who witnessed it left. The law wasn't violated. And then we've got to make sure we understand he has to deal with the woman's sin. When Jesus says, I don't condemn you either, he's not saying what you did was okay. What he asked was, where are the witnesses? Who are the ones who can vow for this? They're gone. Well, I can't vouch for that either. I didn't see it. I didn't witness it. So I can't condemn you in that. But Jesus knew there was sin involved. How did he deal with it? Stop it. Quit it. No more. Don't do it again. Jesus didn't overlook sin. He didn't violate the law of Moses, nor did he overlook sin. And so here's all the things. We look at that and we kind of read through it, and we're familiar enough with it that we can kind of paraphrase it. But he's dealing with a lot of serious issues here. He's got to keep the law. That's what he came to do. He's got to rebuke hypocrisy, and he can't ignore sin in anybody's life. And he did it in the way the master teacher always did it. He did it perfectly. Everything that needed to be dealt with, he dealt with it. And he dealt with it right. That's what Jesus did. As much as we know about this, as familiar we are with that text, and as wonderful lessons as there are in it, and as many applications that can be made from it, unfortunately, and you know this as well as I do, unfortunately, Jesus' words, Jesus' answer to the lady and to those Pharisees has been blatantly misapplied. Many use this passage as a reply to any and everybody who would dare try to tell them that they're wrong. They use this verse. They might not know much else about anything Jesus said, but this world is full of people who can say, oh, if you've never sinned, then you can say it. Oh, don't come to me about my sin unless you yourself have never sinned. You that are without sin. That's not what Jesus was saying. We have seen that's not what he was saying. But you know people use it. And they may have used it on you. Because you have tried to show someone their error. Because you've had to go to somebody in an uncomfortable setting and say, you shouldn't have done this. You handled it wrong. And then they just... Are you perfect? Because if you're not perfect, you can't come tell me. And this is the passage they'll go to. So I'm asking a serious question. That's what we're going to try to look at today. Since we are imperfect and because we have sinned, can we rebuke somebody else in their sin? Do we have the responsibility to do that? Do we have the right in God's eyes to do it? Does this text teach that no one who has ever sinned, no one who is imperfect, can at any setting go to somebody about sin? Let's look at what Jesus said about it, first of all. Look in Matthew chapter 18. Since Jesus was the one speaking in John chapter 8, let's go to where Jesus spoke again. to see if he is going to contradict himself. Matthew chapter 18. And the point I want us to see is that Jesus did lay upon us a burden of approaching other people who are in sin. And so whatever it is that casting stones was talking about, it wasn't a blanket prohibition. Because look how clearly he teaches us in chapter 18. Look in verse 15. If a brother, not talking about a brother in the flesh, spiritual brother. If a brother trespasses against you, go and tell him his fault between him and you alone. Don't go call everybody in the county. Don't put it in the Coleman Times. You get their attention. You and them alone. And then what? If he hears you, you've gained a brother. That's hopefully how it will end. Hopefully you, with an honest heart, will go to someone who's done wrong and they will have an honest heart and they'll say, you're exactly right and I got to fix it. And if that's how it ends, you know how many people in this universe know it? Two people. You and them. That's how many people breathing will know it. You and them. Go to in verse 15. Let them know. Lord willing, they'll repent and it's all fixed. And unfortunately, you and I know that doesn't always work though, right? It's how it should, but it doesn't. Verse 16. If he will not hear, stubbornness, hard-hearted, arrogance, whatever. If he will not hear, take one or two others so that at the mouth of witnesses, every word can be established. You will have somebody who can back you in what happened. You go to him alone. If that doesn't work, you take some witnesses so that others can vouch for what you said, how you said it, and how they other responded. Verse 17. If that doesn't work, if they refuse to hear them, tell it to the group. Tell it to the church. Do you see the progression in which Jesus laid a responsibility and burden upon us? If there is sin in this is totally individual nature. Someone has sinned against you. Rebuke them. Go let them know. If that doesn't end it, then others. If that doesn't end it, then... Here's the point. When Jesus was teaching us to do that, he was just as aware of our imperfections as he was in John chapter 8. He wasn't bipolar. And in John chapter 8, he realized people were imperfect, so therefore we can't rebuke anyone. And in Matthew 15, he forgot that, or Matthew 18 rather. Jesus didn't forget that man can be imperfect. Jesus didn't forget that man has faults and weaknesses now. Matthew chapter 18 is very, very clear of our responsibilities. John chapter 8 doesn't contradict that. He was dealing with their hypocrisy and the manner in which they were there. We won't turn back a few pages, but remember in Matthew chapter 14, we had an example of that. When John the Baptist went before Herod, he said, that's not your wife. You don't have a right to her. That's your brother Philip's wife. That was a rebuke. It's not because John was perfect. It was John understanding he had a responsibility. And me and you got to understand the same responsibility. Jesus taught it. Did his apostles teach it? Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 5. And as you're turning there, I want to throw an easy question out to you. Was the church at Corinth perfect? Have you ever read the letter? Of course they weren't perfect. That letter, from basically start to finish, is a series of rebukes. A series of corrections of things they had gotten wrong. In chapters 1 through 4, they were divisive. They had broken themselves up into sects and to different little sections of the group. Chapter 6, they couldn't even work out issues among themselves. They were going to worldly people to handle issues among themselves. In chapter 7, they had marriage divorce issues. Chapters 8, 9, and 10, they were still going to idolatrous feasts. Chapters 11, 12, 13, 14, the services in many ways had just become a travesty. They had turned the Lord's Supper into a common meal, and even in that's bad enough, but they weren't even sharing at that. They were making the poor look at them. The spiritual gifts had become basically a hierarchy, and they made fun of others because they couldn't prophesy or speak in tongues. The assemblies was people from all at all different times speaking up, and nobody could even learn and hear or edify. No, they weren't perfect at all. There was a lot of things in that church Paul's having to fix. Imperfect group. And here's what they were told. In chapter 5, there was a man in that church who was in adultery, and everybody knew it. I don't mean everybody in the church. I mean everybody in the town. Even non-Christians. It was such a shock. He had taken his own father's wife. We would say he took his stepmom. That's who he's married with. That's who he's living with. Everybody knew it. And even in an immoral city, it was scandal. And the church had not done a thing about it. Verse 6. Your glorying is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lot? Drop down to verse 13. Those that are without God, judges, you put away from among yourself the wicked person. He told them back in verse 11, don't even eat. There are people you can't eat with. There are people you have to separate yourselves from. The bottom line, the point I'm trying to show us is, the church at Corinth wasn't perfect. And yet Paul writes to them and says, you've got to pass some judgments. There are people you have got to purge out of your life, out of your assemblies, out of your group. They can't remain there. You've got to cast them out to a group of imperfect people. That's how clear the teaching was. Look at 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. And as you're turning there, I'll ask the same question. Was the church in Thessalonica perfect? No, Paul's having to correct some things there too. They had gotten a wrong idea about the return of the Lord, and they were expecting it to be so imminent and so soon that they had just basically put life on hold to the point where they quit working. And why should I worry about fields? I'm not going to be here this winter anyway. The Lord's coming back. Why should I worry about the Lord's coming back? Got to worry about all that. And so Paul has to correct some teaching with that church as well. They had gotten idle. They just weren't very active. Verse 6, we command you, brethren. 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 6. We command you, brethren, in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, that you withdraw yourselves from every brother that walks disorderly and not after the tradition, the customs that he received of us. The church of Thessalonica composed of imperfect people, but they were told to withdraw from those who were disorderly. The best idea I think we could probably get of that is to imagine a marching band who are so precise and whose steps, you've got 150 people all with their left foot in the air at the same time. And they all are doing the same things. Their instrument comes down and they go up at the same time. You've all seen that uniform action. Orderly action. All together, all obeying the same steps and actions, and then one who's disorderly. One who is not in step with the others. Now imagine that in the spiritual application. We've been given marching orders. And what Paul's telling the Thessalonians is, if there's someone who refuses to march by that, to walk by that, they are disorderly, then you have to mark them. To imperfect people, he's saying you've got to mark the disorderly. We won't turn to Revelation 2 and 3, letters to the seven churches. You remember it was a circular letter. It went from one church to the next, to the next, to the next. I have something against you. I know your works, and I have something against you. To the Ephesians, I know your works, and I'm going to take your candlestick away. You're not going to be mine anymore. And would you have a problem with that being said and read to the church at Philadelphia? Philadelphia knowing about Sardis. Sardis knowing about Thyatira. They were circular letters. Do you have a problem with those rebukes that were given? Do you have a problem with that? Could we turn there and read them today? And would you have a problem with the rebukes that were given? No. John was writing by inspiration. Ephesians chapter 5, 2 Timothy chapter 4, rebuke, reprove. Jesus taught us there are things you have to say. Paul and John and Peter, they taught us there are things we have to say to those that are disorderly. So how do we reconcile that? Do not cast stones unless you are without sin. And yet the Corinthians, who had plenty of sin, were told to withdraw. The Thessalonians, who had plenty of sin, were told to withdraw. How do we reconcile it? We've got to understand all the issues Jesus was dealing with. He had to deal with the law of Moses. The law of Moses was there had to be witnesses. Those witnesses that had come to him with that lady were wrong. They were in sin themselves by their hypocrisy in that they only brought, first of all, they only brought half the act. And that's what Jesus was saying. Casting stones was a statement made to get to their hypocritical judgments. That's what Matthew 7 is teaching, the same thing. Another verse that everybody seems to know, judge not lest you be judged. That verse, that's not teaching not to judge either. The rest of that context tells us that. It's hypocritical judgments that Matthew 7 is condemning, and it's hypocritical judging, hypocritical stone casting that John 8 is speaking of. And we need to have an answer for that. The next time someone says to you, oh, he without sin, make sure, even if it's a Christian, that they know what that's about. That they know what Jesus was teaching there. There is a difference. With all that weakness that was in the, and sin that was in the church at Corinth, there is a difference in weaknesses and then out and out lifestyle rebellion. And that's what he was showing them about that man. There's a difference in weaknesses that we all suffer from and we all fall to. And then when we just quit. Quit fighting, quit marching orderly, and we just go off to our own beat. That's a different deal. To judge others when we're doing something much worse. That's different than what Paul was doing. To judge others when we ourselves not even making a decent attempt at walking orderly. That is not what Paul was telling the Thessalonians. Let's make sure we see the difference. Let's make sure we have an answer for what we're supposed to do. Look in Galatians chapter 6. We'll look at just two more verses. Galatians chapter 6. Continually remember to guard ourselves. We'll be looking at this verse in our Wednesday study very, very soon. Just a matter of weeks. Galatians chapter 6, verse 1. Brethren, if a man is overtaken in a fault, a trespass, a sin, you that are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. Let's not ever forget that. Look to ourselves. We have been given a responsibility. And it's a weighty responsibility. We are our brother's keeper. And there are times when we will have to make some rebukes. Don't ever forget our own frailties. And that's where the Pharisees dropped it. But Satan is at work. And that's one reason why that idea about casting stones is out there. He wants us to close our eyes to the truth, to the responsibility, by having us resent the reproving. Here's the heart we need to have. Last verse. Look in Isaiah chapter 66. Here's the heart you and I need. Satan wants us to close our eyes to it because it's a reproof and it's a rebuke. And he wants us to just, well, they've sinned themselves. How dare they? Even if someone who has sinned comes and shows us our own sin, does their sin remove ours? Does their sin somehow, does it nullify what we have done? No, it doesn't. And we need to have a heart that loves truth, no matter where and how it comes. Verse 2, I want us to look at that. Actually, look in verse 1 to set it up. Thus says the Lord, the heaven is my throne, earth is my footstool. Where is the house that you built upon me? Where is the place of my rest? All these things are of my hand. I made them all. But this is what I'm looking for. These are the ones I show favor to. Him that has a poor and contrite spirit and who trembles at my word. In a nutshell, does that describe you? Poor, contrite heart who trembles, shakes at the word. Does that describe me? If you and I tremble at the word and someone comes and shows us where we have violated the word, it shouldn't make any difference to us who it is that's the messenger. Shouldn't make any difference to us their own shortcomings. If we tremble at the word and we have a poor and contrite heart, God will show favor to us. And that's regardless of the source of truth. Let's just be appreciative of truth. And let's not try to hide behind some phrase of, oh, you're not perfect yourself, so how dare you rebuke me. If I need to be rebuked, let's be rebuked. If you need to be rebuked, let's take it with a contrite heart, trembling at the word, and let's just appreciate the opportunity to repent. Get your songbooks out. We have sinned. And we are not perfect. But God's expecting us to get closer and closer toward that. And that's our invitation. Before we go any farther into our Bible classes, into our studies, and we break off, if we need to make anything correct so that our worship can be acceptable, we'll do it now while we stand and sing that first verse.